We just want to make a comment about fragrances. If you come to the lodge, if you're at home, you can do it however you wish. Okay, it's 11 now. Okay, officially, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are a hybrid meeting now on Sundays. We are open from 10:30 until 11 before the meeting, and then the meeting begins at 11. It ends promptly at noon. So we just want everyone to know that you are welcome here with certain protocols, which we're probably all aware of anyway. So we operate on the basis of impersonality. So no side issues or personal anecdotes. So everyone feels welcome and no one feels excluded. And we ask everyone to please mute if you are not actively speaking. And so that's about it. We have a student volunteer who is going to read the declaration and give the announcements. And we will mute in the meantime. Thank you.
Good morning again, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Before we begin, we would like to inform you that the class this morning is on the subject of human perfectibility, the doctrine of human perfectibility. Next week, we will continue our study or looking at basic theosophical ideas. And next week, we're going to look at great souls, the flower of human perfectibility. And that will be a panel. Our meetings begin at 11 a.m. promptly and are over at 12 noon on Sunday mornings. On Wednesdays, we also have a study class where we are reading together The Ocean of Theosophy. We're on chapter 3, Human Constitution. And that meeting starts at 7:30 and ends at 8:45. And then on Friday, we have a an open meeting, a forum, where we take up a portion of Mr. Judge's Echoes from the Orient. And we read those together and we talk and discuss them. And that begins at 6:30 and ends at 7:30. Now, all these programs are put on by voluntary contributions from all who consider themselves theosophists. And all are welcome to participate in this activity at the United Lodge in Philadelphia. Now, why do we gather together? Well, we have a declaration, and we like to keep that in the forefront of why we are here. Because there is a policy, and that is of independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. There's no attachment to any theosophical organization. And we are loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement. So therefore, we're not concerned with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work we have here on hand is way too absorbing and too lofty to have time or inclination to take part in side issues. Our work here is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and try to put these practices into action through a truer realization of self and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. Now, the basis for union among theosophists is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. We have no constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between these associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. We regard as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without any distinctions, race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And we welcome everyone to our association, for all those who are in accord with this declared purpose and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, in endeavor to carry out this declaration, we have those three weekly meetings in Philadelphia. Now, this morning's meeting is a forum, which is a small talk, a short talk, on a theosophical idea or teaching. And that's why it is called the doctrine. It is a teaching of human perfectibility. So now we'll have a student present to us this idea of the basic or the doctrine of human perfectibility.
The doctrine of human perfectibility. This doctrine is easily comprehended by some men, but is extremely difficult for others due to centuries of dissemination of the degrading and infamous doctrine that man is originally sinful, basically defective, and inherently imperfect. If it may be said of man, the microcosm of the universe, it may also be said of the universe, the macrocosm. This universe is originally sinful, is inherently imperfect, and was damned from the beginning. All the rest is merely carrying out that sentence into execution. Yet no one would think of maligning the universe in this manner. Even materialistic scientists have more respect than that for the mysteries of nature. The whole story of original sin is a monstrous priestly invocation of the power of evil, making deliberate appeal to man's fear. For man, through ignorance, listens to the priestly voice. Listening, he becomes a slave when he should be free. Better to be the worst sinner who ever lived upon this earth than to be a man who, in the name of the Most High, demands the moral obedience, the intellectual servility, the spiritual blindness of millions through their love. For the man who is a forthright sinner demands and damns only himself. Whereas the man who preaches the original sin, a sin merely of being born, dams at its source the current of divinity that should flow through a human life. Why is a man willing to assume this burden of guilt handed to him by priests? Partly, no doubt, because he is ever conscious of his many failures to live up to his better impulses and higher aspirations. But in greater measure, it is due to emphasis on outward action, especially on forms of worship, rather than on inner motive. Thus, one may feel guilty because he is not perfect, and a second may throw off all responsibility for himself because he is just a poor, miserable sinner. What do you expect? Well, guess what? Both of these are wrong. Theosophy says that each man must live his own life, not another's. He must do his own work, attend to his own duties, and accept his own responsibilities. Howsoever more enriched or rewarding the life may seem to a man, he is not free to try to live that life until he has fulfilled himself in his own place. The doctrine of the perfectibility of man synthesizes the fundamental concepts of theosophy, that there is one source of life and consciousness pervading the universe, that life and consciousness move according to a law inherent in them, that self-conscious beings progress by effort directed in accordance with these laws. Great nature has herself impelled us far along the road of evolution. We can see that however inferior we may be to the highest being, we can already conceive, even if we cannot be, we can already imagine, even though we cannot yet embody. However short we may fall from the high ideal of the soul, the spiritual being, the perceiver, yet we can see that we stand far, far higher in the school of life than our brothers in the lesser halls of learning. In the great school of life, the lowest of men is immeasurably higher than the highest animal. The lowest animal is immeasurably higher in the scale than the highest of the vegetable kingdom. And what a godsome monarch is a green leaf plant on a stony hillside, creeping forth from a crevice in a rock, compared with the mineral kingdom. Then when we think of the voiceless air and of the immense silent and to us untried spaces that fill most of the universe visible to us, we can see that the humble dust under our feet represents an immense graduated advance over to us what is a void. In the seemingly infinite gradations of beings making up the universe, we call those men who have attained perfection in action adepts. Adepts are in facts in nature and ideals for men to emulate. This emulation consists in studying to know oneself and in working for humanity. As we learn more and more of the philosophy that these adepts first tested, then formulated and preserved, and finally presented to the world through H.P. Blavatsky, we find ourselves gradually growing in human stature. Despite recurrent failures, despite interims of passivity, perhaps even despite wayward wandering, we find ourselves becoming better human beings. The doctrine assumes the perfectibility of humanity and will destroy the awful theory of inherent original sin, which has held the ground down the Western Christian nations for centuries. But far from being out of concordance with the religion of Jesus, it is in accord. Jesus and St. Paul taught the unity of spiritual beings, or men, when they said that heaven and the Spirit of God were in us. And the doctrine of unity is one of the oldest and most important of the Brahmanical scheme. The possibility of arriving at perfection by means of religion and science combined, as found in theosophy, is common to Buddhism and Brahmanism and is not contrary to the teaching. Jesus said to his disciples that they could, if they would, do even greater works, miracles than he did. To do these works, one has to have great knowledge and power. The doctrine assumes the perfectibility of humanity and destroys the theory of original sin. But far from being out of concordance with the religion of Jesus, it is in perfect accord. He directed his followers to be perfect, even as the Father is in heaven. They could not come up to that command by any possibility unless man has the power to reach to that high state. Hence then, whether we look broadly over the field at mere ritual dogmas or at ethics, we find the most complete accord between theosophy and Christianity. The ability to improve one's nature a little bit proves the ability to continue improvement. Given the process of reincarnation, there is no necessary stopping point save the perfection of the great day of evolution. This is the logic of the doctrine of perfectibility. It becomes an unequivocal fact for those who attain. Hopefully this small introductory talk will point us to the conclusion that an understanding of theosophical doctrines such as karma and reincarnation and the daily practice of good works will transport us all to that longed-for day when the great ideal of universal brotherhood will be realized and will bring to the forefront the common ground on which all faiths may stand and from which every nation may work for the good and the perfection of the human family. Once again, the topic for today is the doctrine of human perfectibility.
Unmute, please.
Yes, we would like to add that all of life is conscious. So therefore, if it is conscious, it is divine in its essence. And the doctrine of human perfectibility is ever growing from the elemental kingdom to the mineral kingdom to the vegetable to the animal to the human. It's an ever expanding outward, and we are in a cyclic evolution where man, or the perfectibility of man, is becoming more and more evident because the mind is now opening. And we are now on the upward swing of the evolutionary process. But are there any questions about this idea of human perfectibility? SL?
In the scheme of evolution presented to us, we see a gradual perfecting of possibility of intelligence, as said, going from the mineral up through and past the human kingdom. But with the doctrine of human perfectibility, when it's specified that way, relates specifically to the fact that different from all the other kingdoms, in the human kingdom we have a thinker, a self-conscious being capable of making choices. What is the importance of the fact that the human being is a thinking, self-conscious being in terms of that individual's perfectibility?
Well, this becomes sort of the pivotal point in the focus of evolution, because that inward impulse of coming forward or ever growing is a part of the natural process until it reaches the human kingdom. And when it reaches the human kingdom, the light of mind is lit up and man is able to make a choice. And therefore, he has the ability to choose. And it's stated in the SD that qualities of the human kingdom, or the self-realized or the self-conscious being, is self-analyzing reflection, which enables us to become co-creators with nature.
There's an audience participant that has a hand. Please. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the way perfectibility works then is we receive our karma, and it's by the choices that we make. And as self-conscious beings, we know that we have the responsibility. We understand how things will turn out by those choices. So it's our choices that we make based on what karma brings to us that leads us on this road to perfection, right?
Did everyone hear that?
Please repeat it.
Okay, it's our choices. We're responsible for our choices along the way, right?
Yes.
For everything.
Yes, it's exactly that. We are responsible, but when we were ignorant, we were sort of innocent in a way that we had no idea of our responsibility, because, as stated in our talk, is that religion has set up a roadblock for humanity to realize their true nature, for us to realize that you cannot perfect anything that is not inherently perfect. so that the potentiality for perfectibility is there. You know, it's just that because of the ideas that we hold to be true, we're being held back. We're being held back. And that's why the doctrine of universal brotherhood is so much at the forefront of this doctrine of perfectibility.
Thank you. There's no follow-up. I asked. There's no follow-up.
Okay. Anyone else?
We have a question.
Please.
It was just stated that, in a sense, if we don't know any better, maybe we're not phrasing it right. Let me put it another way. In the Voice of the Silence, it talks about that we must regain the child state. So on one hand, we think about children as being innocent and irresponsible, but is that what is really meant in the Voice of the Silence by regaining the child state in light of what we know?
Well, we think that we have to, that child state is a state of mind. It's a state of mind. It's, we are enthralled with children because they make us feel good, because we can identify with that freedom that a child has, that they're not encumbered by beliefs and constraints of society and responsibilities of life. So I think we have a comment. If someone would read that.
Sure. Yes. Okay. The comment is, the child state is a state where the child has a flexible brain, meaning they can learn and unlearn and learn something new and readjust way easier than grown-ups.
So true. So true. Because what happens to us as we get older, we have these, we gather these ideas that we think are true, and we carry them around, and we look everywhere to justify that idea that we think is true, and we sort of fool ourselves in the reality of what is really going on. But that's why it's stated, it's this self-analyzing reflection. You know, what is that? What is self-analyzing reflection? How would that be a factor in growth and perfectibility?
Well, it's said that we are ceaselessly deceived, so we always have to be on guard. And there's someone else in the audience. We don't know what the pecking order is here, but there's that audience, another. Okay.
Okay. So the question was, what is self-analyzing? Because wisdom is related to knowing how to apply the law or which principle to apply in a given situation. So if we're reflecting on what we're doing, all we're doing is questioning ourselves, did I do the right thing at the right time? So So we may conclude that we did, or we may conclude that we didn't. We're not looking to pat ourselves on the back, and we're not looking to criticize ourselves, but we're just looking to either validate the situation objectively or invalidate. So next time we come up to a similar situation, we may be more prepared to make a better decision. So that would seem to be the purpose for self-reflection.
So wisdom is the proper application of the law. And we are self-analyzing all the time and adjusting and
you're freezing at the lodge. Well, self-analyzing reflection is that process of learning. You know, we do what we think is best, and we see what the results are. So therefore, we are ever analyzing our very being. So the task therefore becomes, we have to become the eternal witness of our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. That's where our path lies.
And so we have a follow-up.
Well, so if you know, we think of the theosophical teaching that man's a sevenfold being, is responsible for his own perfectibility and to participate in and co-create a perfect universe around him. This sevenfold being, where do you start? Which part do you start? How do you know? Like, is it like playing the piano all seven at the same time, or what?
All right, we're sevenfold beings. How do we know where to start? And our sevenfold principle, where do we make a beginning? Where does that lie?
Yeah, we make a beginning where we are. Where we are. So where are we? Where are we? We're in these gross physical forms. We live in a world that where the passional nature is developed to its highest extent, and that spirituality has been degraded and obscured from the human consciousness, and that now we see a breaking forth of light or of knowledge of the true nature of man. Never before in the history of mankind has it been, as a portion of these ancient truths, been written down. And we can find in the secret doctrine the pilgrimage of the soul through the realms and what develops and how it develops. It's all an expression of that divine spark of which everything is. Yes, S-J-C. Yes, J-C-S.
Yes.
So it would seem then, if we look at the teachings of where we are, that we are soul incarnate in the physicality, that we are soul beingness, a radiant of the absolute, then the powers that we have right now, the power to be that soul and look and think and test all experiences in the face of desires, that process is the starting point. And that's the unifying point, isn't it? That's the point of universal brotherhood, that soul is, and that it perceives, it has the power to think, and then that goes forth. So Aristotle would be busy looking at the seven different planes and seven different states of consciousness and trying to piece it together. But Plato's advice was to start with the fundamental principles and then see if they hold up as we have all these fragmented experiences and karmic events.
Yes, the idea of looking at universals and into particulars, or particulars to universals, is that we evolve from spirit. We didn't evolve from matter. The forms that we have, they've evolved from matter, but we are divine beings, in essence, that has descended into matter, and we have lost or forgotten our spiritual nature. So, what we are trying to do with each other is awaken in ourselves that light, that understanding, because it's there. We are perfectible, you know, and that this knowledge is inherent within us. But how do we do that? How do we perfect ourselves?
We would just like to make an observation that in Plato's allegory of the caves, we are mistaking, the gist of it is we're mistaking shadows for reality. And then we're also chained. So we're chained to these ideas that the forum speaker talked about being chained really by religious authorities to false ideas.
Yes. And that is what chains us to this existence, is our ideas that we hold to be true. You know, we live our life through the ideas or the ideals which we have embedded in our very being. That's how we live our life. We see every human being trying to elevate themselves to a better understanding, but they're hampered by the ideas that they hold to be true. We're not these bodies. You know, we didn't evolve from the animal. We endowed the human form with divine light, or the animal form, we should say.
Thank you.
Yes.
There's another audience participant. Go ahead.
Then there's the allegory of the elephant and the blind man.
The allegory of the elephant and the blind man.
That it all has to do with your perception on what is going on around you, so that you can make the choices. But then if you're getting wrong information, if you have wrong knowledge, because you're not really seeing the truth, then those choices will be erroneous.
So each person in that allegory that was blind but felt a different part of the elephant came up with a different concept, and so part of the picture. So that's the summary of that.
Yeah, that's a restatement of universals of particulars. You know, that what is the universal idea, and it's based on that idea that we are a unity, we are a oneness. We are immutable, omnipresent, eternal. That in our very essence, we are unchanging. So that we have the universal teaching that from it all has come forth. Well, that's what happens with life. It comes forth from it. or that, because everything is conscious. So if we keep that in mind, that we are a unity, what affects one affects all. You know, we only see the physical plane, but we know that there is an astral plane. That's the causal plane. And then we wonder why we have such physical disasters enveloping humanity at this point. It's just an effect from actions done in the past and at present, actions of the mind, the thoughts, the words, and the deeds of humanity over thousands and thousands of years. So everything that comes to us is for a reason. For everything, there is a cause. So we are told in the Gita that we should live for now, but live for tomorrow by the actions that we perform. It's by sacrifice, by giving up the results of one's deeds, leave them to the universe. And your only need is to consider your motive for doing this. Do it because it needs to be done, with no self-identifying attachment. And develop concentration so that one is able to develop these powers that are coming into manifestation. We are moving forward, and as our thoughts change, so do our bodies. I think we had our class on Friday, this point was brought up, that how we think, it actually changes the human form.
So it's which principles that are operating at the time, is that? In other words, the earlier comment was about the seven principles and where do we start. And the desire principle is actually overdeveloped, but we are mind beings. So manas is the principle that needs a lot of our attention. But of course, we're under the sway of desire and the astral and all that stuff that comes to the fore. But we usually don't have to worry too much about what we need to work on because it's right in front of our eyes, isn't it not? Is it not?
We would think so. You know, so it comes to us. But our challenge is to control that passional nature. Become the master or the captain of our ship. We are riding this horse, we could say, or this animal, and we need to control the animal. It wants to be controlled. It wants to be guided to a higher state of consciousness. But, you know, we are self-indulgent. And so in this day, or however old that we have become, there are certain things that we enjoy.
So we need to weigh anchor and get underway.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, well, we're chained.
I think we're underway and maybe caught in a storm somewhere. Yeah, right. And yes, but we're always moving, and we are invited to grab hold of an idea that will help anchor us in reality. And that anchor is our true nature. Our true nature. You know, we are divine in our true nature. We are perfectible. And sure, we have to give up or sacrifice those things which we hold dear. I don't want to give that up. No one knows I enjoy that. Only me. You know, so we go about and we have these sneaky pleasures, you know, that somehow make us feel comfortable. You know, we have a certain mindset. We have certain things from childhood that we have become attached to. And not that we shouldn't indulge ourselves, but we should use those as lessons for us to look into.
Yes.
And investigate.
And before studying theosophy, many in the world do, like to think that they're getting away with their sneaky little pleasures and that there's no consequences. Yeah. And that's a great joy for people that think that they're getting away with it.
And that's very true. I mean, I think that's part of human nature. Now we are so selfish to an extent that we don't really understand, but that just is an example of it. We lie to ourselves. We lie to ourselves. And no one knows, only me. And what big deal does that make? You know, I didn't hurt anybody but myself, because I, you make a pledge or a commitment, or like in the beginning of the year, you know, you'd make a declaration about what you want to do or how you want to be. You know, that strengthens the will by keeping these promises that we make to ourselves, by keeping these commitments that we make to ourselves. It makes the will stronger because it is a battle. We are on the plane of Kurukshetra. We are engaged in this battle, and the battle is with our lower nature. Now, I think we see a flash.
There's a chat. Should I read it?
Please. You're freezing.
We have already reached the nature/qualities of godliness, yet not everyone reaches the level of a Dhyan Chohan. There is no absolute limit to perfectibility. Why are certain evolutionary leaps not allowed now? Okay, so that's why are there no leaps? We're told there's no leaps. But
what do we know of nature? There's no leaps in nature. Everything is a gradual unfolding from within outward. And there's no limit on perfectibility. We only know we're only on a certain plane of perception. You know, in our consciousness, we haven't even have a glimpse of a consciousness that we possess, because we are limited in our perceptions. They're unfolding before us. And we are only given these teachings, but as a small portion of the greater teachings, because we couldn't comprehend it. Because we think we're poor, miserable sinners. We think that, even though we say, but we struggle with that. You know, when we do things that we know We shouldn't. And we have guilt and remorse. You know, then we know we're still caught up in that. We're still caught up in that.
Second chat?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. In communication with another, we may perceive or project imperfections from the other and or ourselves. Is it better to focus on helping the other and forgetting what they are revealing about ourselves?
Well, it's very a point well made that these all, what we see in others lie within us. So how do we report or approach us? How will we want to be approached about a problem or a hindrance or a blockage that we are, you know, stumbling with or fighting against? Like, for instance, impersonality, which is perhaps the most difficult quality to bring under control, because our personality is how we've been communicating with the world. And it's not that we don't use our personality to communicate, but we try to eliminate that personal aspect so that we can gravitate to the impersonal, so that when we talk amongst each other, we try not to provoke the personal to rear its head, because it will fight for its existence, because this philosophy is where we have to stifle, not to, well, I don't gotta be careful what the words we use, but to conquer our lower passions and desires, to make them numb or blind to our very being, that we become the masters. So that the only way we can do this is by confronting them. And there's something in the Secret Doctrine that we found very interesting about perfection. Perfection, to be fully such, must be born out of imperfection. The incorruptible must grow out of the corruptible, having the latter as its vehicle and basis and contrast. Absolute light is absolute darkness, and vice versa. So that's very interesting, because if we are to understand perfection, we've come from imperfection. That's where we are. And some of us have started on that journey. Well, we all have started on that journey. Even if we're ignorant of our true nature, we have started on that journey. Because even the ignorant are self-conscious. Even the ignorant can be woken to these ideas, because it's like a candle. You know, we can light another candle. And how do we do that? By the ideas that we express and how we express them. JCS?
Well, if we try to use ideas and symbols without the overlay of personality or desire or sensation, then should we consider the subject for this morning from the linear point of view, that there's a destination, there is perfection that will be attained? Or is it more correct to consider this topic from a cyclical, cycling, circling, if you will, spiraling process of becoming perfectible, but having an eternal perfectibility, one that has no limits? So is it finite and linear, or is it circular and eternal?
There are relative truths or relative perfections and absolute perfection. You know, it can be looked at, you know, the relative really pertains to this plane of existence, but there is a higher planes of existence that have more to deal with the absolute rather than the relative. And there is a natural progression of this perfectibility, as you implied. It's a spiraling effect, that it's ever becoming, because again, it's said that after the fourth round, we begin the upward spiral back into spirit. And we think it's a really some help if we go to the secret doctrine and sort of amuse ourselves with some of the ideas that are found there, because the secret doctrine speaks to our higher nature, our intuitive nature, and that we find ourselves engulfed in another realm of reality. On page 188 in book one of the secret doctrine, what has gone through are the rounds and the races, and you know, we become fascinated by that, but those ideas fully express the spiraling effect, this going around and around each of the globes, which are seven. Now, this may seem technical or sometimes it's confusing, but we need to just consider it and play with it. And you know, it talks about that.
We have another audience participant.
Well, let's go. We only have a few minutes left.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
If we could go back to the original talk that was given, there was a comparison of original sin versus inherent perfectibility. And it was just said a minute ago that perfectibility is, the SD said, perfectibility is born out of imperfection, or the perfected being is born out of imperfection. So then, is there a difference between something being imperfect and something, you know, being originally sinful?
Okay, if the human being if perfectibility is born out of imperfectibility, what about originally sinful? What's the difference between the two?
Well, that's an abomination, originally sinful. The imperfection is not evil, is not sinful. It's just imperfect. It's an imperfect expression of its divinity. But it cannot become divine if it doesn't have contrast, something to contrast it with. And that's why it is said that nothing comes from, you can't be perfect and know that you're perfect if you don't know what imperfect is.
So as we honor this cycle here, we are closing the meeting at 12 o'clock, and all are welcome to participate, whether on Zoom or at 1917 Walnut Street. We will be open on Sundays going forward. We have the Wednesday night meeting and the Friday night meeting exclusively on Zoom. And we thank you all in this great experiment of the hybrid meeting. Thank you all.